Welcome to the Children's Law Podcast, brought to you by True North Child Advocates, where we believe that advocacy is the answer. Hey everybody, it's Angela, and today I'm here with John, and we're going to talk about a topic that you deal with in almost all of your cases, and that is evaluating placements.
Right. And why do we want to talk about evaluating placements? I think that's actually a very good threshold question for us, right? Because I'm sure a lot of our listeners around the country, for a lot of us, the decision on placement is the agency's decision. It's the state's decision, right? They decide if a placement is licensed or not, if a placement is safe or not. That's theirs. I mean, I can even imagine some experienced attorneys are thinking, you know, that's a slippery slope. You know, when you're going to start evaluating placements, are you equipped to do that really? You know, we're not really hold ourselves out as experts in risk assessment, right? We don't want to expose ourselves to liability and things like that. But there are reasons why we are uniquely positioned to evaluate our clients' placements, and there's reasons we need to do it. So I want to just talk about that real quick before we dive in, okay? So like the two whys for me are one, the placement can really impact your mission with your client, your strategy, your overall strategy. We have to remember how the agency is making the placement decision. Okay, what's their motivating factor? What's their agenda? And honestly, what is it, right, Angela? In every place we've worked, every place we've gone?
Just gotta find a bed.
We aspire to more, right? But that's right. That's where we're at. That's where every place we've worked is at. Is that placements are there's a shortage of them. And so that's the agenda, and that's not your client's agenda necessarily. And that first placement can so impact your planning later on. So it's important to keep that why in your mind when you're evaluating placement. The other why is that the home studies are performed by our child welfare workers, our child welfare case managers, right? And we all know that that workforce has historically suffered from a lot of turnover. So you have staff that is often new and inexperienced, perhaps lacking a certain degree of supervision or support. And I can tell you from just, you know, right, just our own careers, right? When you're inexperienced and new to this profession, you don't know what you don't know. So you can be looking at a red flag, you're waving in your face and not see it, right?
Yeah.
So that's one part of the questioning the home studies and the source of them coming from a workforce that does suffer from turnover. The other part of that is that child welfare workforce is performed by largely social workers or people who are hopefully trained in some degree of social work, right? And of course, social workers are generally strength focused. We as attorneys, though, as many of you know, you've gone to law school and you come out and you're transformed somewhat by your education into being liability focused. I don't know if you're like me, but if you walk into the grocery store and you see something spilled on aisle
five.
See
the water on the floor.
Yeah, right? It's like every cell in my body is like, I have to tell someone. Someone's going to sue.
And not only liability, but like I was a corporate lawyer. My whole job was to find things that were done incorrectly. So just an eye for omissions. And I did want to add too, when we think about the case managers, they are also part of a local culture that there may be a lot of pressure, whether it's to just get kids placed anywhere or to place with any possible relative. And not to say that that shouldn't be what we try to do, but the point is cultural is not the right word, but there is a local kind of way of going about things that they operate in, whether they're new or experienced. And so they may be feeling pressures that a lawyer looking at their individual client isn't feeling.
Yes. Yeah. There's that environment that each jurisdiction has, and the workers have to work within that environment that they're handed. And as lawyers, the other thing that we come out of law school with, I would say, in addition to our spider sense, our liability sense, is critical thinking skills, hopefully, that it really hones mm-hmm. your critical thinking skills. And so as we get into some of the strategies that we're going to talk about today, you know, applying critical thinking skills to the document that you are given to read can actually come in very handy. And it can be a real asset, not only to your client, but to the agency as well. The agency and the state and the court, they don't want to overlook stuff either, right? If there's clear and present right. danger, they want to know about it.
Definitely.
So I think we both understand, right, Angela, that this can come off sounding a little paranoid, right? That you know, what are we looking for? You know, where's yeah. the danger, right? And we don't want to say to our listeners, mm-hmm. you know, look under the bed or check the open the refrigerator no. when you go to visit a house. That's not what we're saying here today. But we are aware. I think we're all aware that every jurisdiction has had a foster home or a group home or a relative placement or something that everything seemed fine until, lo and behold, it turned out to be some kind of nightmare scenario for the kids who were living in it, right? And everyone goes, oh my yeah. gosh, right? So these are just some strategies to keep in mind, cognizant of the fact that these things do happen and that you can play a role in detecting and preventing it from happening to your clients.
So just to put what we're talking about in context, one of the oversights that we have seen again and again is maybe not acknowledging a regular visitor to the home. And I think we all know the cases, many of the cases that don't end well are someone who's never been evaluated by the child welfare system, a boyfriend, another visitor that comes over and ultimately harms the children in some way. And so I think just thinking about the absence of a visitor might not really necessarily come to everyone's mind, but if you've been doing this long enough and you're looking at the person you're evaluating and it says, you know, it's a single 23-year-old and there are no known visitors, then maybe that's something that you want to ask a little bit about.
Yeah. So if we dive in to what the child's attorney can do, I think the number one rule is to not look at placements in a vacuum, okay, because it is a different equation for every case and every child. So we don't have a lot of agency here, right? We don't have a lot of control over this because we're not making the placements, and we understand fully that your menu is very limited, probably, right? And so on the other hand, these placements are truly impacting your client's long-term outcomes. So you look at every placement with, you know, is this a home that could serve as a permanent home in the event this case looks like it's going to go adoption? And you don't know at the beginning. Granted, we're not prejudging anything. However, you also do know some things. You very often know, wow, this looks like it should be reunified. This case should be reunified within 6 or 7 months. So therefore, you're not like going to be freaking out going, oh my gosh, I really need these parents to adopt. Because on every case, I mean, we preach fidelity, right? But we don't mean, you know, mindless mm-hmm. fidelity. Like, you know, at some point you realize, we have a limited menu of options, right? So I have to use those foster homes that want to adopt on the kids that are more likely to end up being adoption clients. Whereas if I got a sibling group of four and I'm like, I think they're going home, I think this is a reunification case and I think it's going to work, I got a good feeling, then you're not going to like complain that they placed the kids in a foster home with a 78-year-old woman who's not interested in adopting. You're not going to worry about it, right?
Right.
Will that come back to bite you? Mm-hmm. Possibly, yes. But because you have limited resources, you might just concede that fact and go, fingers crossed, everything goes the way I hope it's going to go, right? And when it doesn't, you can say, oh, I should have practiced with fidelity, like True North people told me on the podcast. Okay, so.
Well, yeah, well, and I think that is something where the lawyer may think differently than the social worker. Again, the social worker or case manager is under pressure to find a place for these kids to stay right away. and you as the lawyer are developing your legal strategy, and you're, and that, and that's really what we mean by, it's part of what we mean by don't look at it in a vacuum.
Right, right. Because on the flip side of that is you have an infant and you have, you know, no father, and you have a mother who's lost three or four other children, and you know that she walks away from the cases very often, she doesn't engage, and then they put that child in a foster home with a 70-year-old, 8-year-old career foster mother who's not interested in adopting, then there you want to, that's where you're going to use your capital, right? That's where you want to say, you know, hey, I may have limited options, but I got to insist here. Or you got a sibling group of five and it's looking like they're not going home. You know, again, the classic scenario, they put the baby in a home with a young couple that's looking to adopt. And you're like, wait a minute, you're separating this baby from their siblings probably forever because you're spreading them to the four corners of the globe here. And I'm not going to be able to get them back together a year from now. So these are the things where we're the ones on the case who should be thinking in these terms at this, in terms of the placement agenda and the placement. It's not a, we can't let it be a vacuum of, oh, we got a bed, let's move on. Everyone's got a bed, everyone's got a place to sleep, we're done. Nope, we don't have that luxury.
Well, and I think another kind of the flip side of looking at placements as long-term is how willing is a foster parent to work with helping a parent get their kids back? How cooperative are they going to be in that environment so that when you've got a case where you see reunification as very likely, are we putting the child somewhere where that person is going to be helping facilitate that?
Yeah, that's so important too, right? Because you've got a case that looks like it's going to go reunification. Ideally, you get a foster parent who's willing to co-parent. That's the dream scenario. But you have to be cognizant that the nightmare scenario also exists, which is the foster parent who wants to adopt the child so desperately that they're going to try to sabotage the parent and say, oh, the child comes back from visitation screaming and I can't get her to go to sleep at night because she's so traumatized and, you know, she shouldn't be seeing her mother unsupervised or she shouldn't be seeing her mother at all. I've had that, you know, you literally... And then,
oh gosh, yeah.
But yeah, your case becomes a fight, like a custody battle almost. And you have to watch for that kind of a dynamic early on. And you have to be aware it's existing at least, you know, get yourself and your client out of it if you need to, if it's one of those extreme cases. I mean, we've been drawn into needless litigation with foster parents who have lawyered up and they don't, you know, they don't have a case, but they, you know, there are lawyers who will take their money and will drag us through litigation needlessly. And you want to avoid that nightmare scenario as well.
Well, and just quickly to back up for people newer to the work, when you say co-parenting, what would that actually look like? What are some of the things that foster parent might do if, when you say, you know, are they open to co-parenting?
I mean, the number one thing that I find that they do is they introduce themselves to the parents, right? They take down the curtain or the wall between them and the parents, and they say, hi, I've got your child. You know, let's have a relationship. You know, they don't have to be best friends, but let's talk. The great ones are the ones who become like a mentor, like, you know, like, you know, I'm toilet training your child. Let me show you how I'm doing it. Let's talk about it, you know, or I'm, you know, tell me what he likes. Tell me what he doesn't like. They involve them. And it becomes the most valuable service we give a parent when we actually have a co-parent, a foster parent who will co-parent, because they often will remain on with the parents' lives as babysitters or as mentors long after the case is over. But it takes a very special kind of person, and we just don't see a lot of it, but when we do, it's just how the foster care system should operate for parents who are struggling and can use that level of support, and it's just a great thing when it happens.
It should be encouraged
when it does happen. I always try to make a point of pointing out to the court, hey, because the judge won't know, right? Judge doesn't know why the case is going so well. So I'll make a point of saying, Judge, I got to point out what the foster parent has done on this case, you know, and what the parent has done by engaging with the foster parent, because that's a threatening dynamic there for a parent to have to, you know, get into a relationship with someone who is taking care of their kid and not feel, you know, slighted or like less than for some reason. So it's a two-way street, but when it works, it's the best thing for the kid. So the other important role that children's attorneys have in this process, and this sounds really basic, but always read the home study. And that probably seems obvious to some, and other people might be listening going, are you kidding me? Like, when should I read the home study? Mm-hmm. I don't have time, right? However,
I don't have a copy.
I don't even have a copy, right? Or they don't send it to us, right? We just mm-hmm. get a piece of paper that says approved, denied. It's different all over. It shouldn't be, but it is. So this is the story I have on this is, and it's a sad story, but there was a client that we were not appointed to, and the client was sent to another county. And as you mentioned just a little earlier, Angela, nobody checked or read that there was a frequent visitor to the home that had not been background checked, right? And mm-hmm. the child, unfortunately, died in the home and was shaken, and it was the frequent visitor who did it, right? And we had people in our child welfare community come to us, magistrate, agency head, and say, "What, you guys weren't on this case. What would you have done had you been on the case?" And I said, "Well, I don't know. I don't have any of the documents. I got to see the home study. They gave it to me." And I said, "Well, we would have read this home study." And then I would have picked up the phone and I just would have called the attorney agency. You know, sooner or later, you don't need to take it to court when you've done it enough, right? When you've read enough mm-hmm. home studies and you've warned them about enough red flags, you don't need to go to court. That you can just call your colleague at the state and say, "Did you see this?" And they go, "Oh, thank you." And I said, "We would have read it. We would have seen this frequent visitor had not been background checked. We would have wanted him to be background checked. There were red flags in his background. We could have safety planned, or we would have fought against the placement." I tell that story because unfortunately the sad outcome drives home the point, but there have been many, many examples over the years where just reading the home study, we have seen obvious red flags. So what are you looking for? Well, like you said, you're looking for frequent visitors that haven't been background checked. You're also looking for frequent visitors who are not in the home study. So, you know, if you have
right.
an aunt, right, with three children, who are their dads, right? Who, she's a young woman. Does she have a partner of any kind? You know, and when I'm told she has no partner, I'm like, she has no love life. She has no social life. Are you sure? Can we, I mean, maybe, possibly, but nobody comes around the house. Mm-hmm. She has three children. So, I mean, of her own. So I know that there are other men in her life. So those obvious questions that don't get asked. There's sometimes an unanswered question that hasn't even been asked yet. It's our role to ask them. And that's, again, the critical thinking that comes into it. Now, the flip side of this, of course, is when you can see a home study that's been denied. But before I move on to that, let me back up a little, because I also want to touch on the abuse registry history check, which should be in the home study for every individual, right? Mm-hmm. Sometimes there are things lying right in there, and you need to read that critically, because as you read down it, you'll see unfounded, 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 and you're like, you know, there are 15 prior reports for substance abuse, and they're all unfounded, but like, and there's no explanation for it, right? It's like, okay, who's calling mm-hmm. these in? I can't find that out, but what's going on? Or there might be one founded, family violence threatens child, or something like that. But it won't tell mm-hmm. you what happened to it, why it's okay to place the child there. Sometimes it's lying right there in the home study. Like, you're going to put a child in a home where there was a founded report for family violence threatens child, or for substance, 15 substance abuse reports, all unfounded. You need to explain that to me. But sometimes they don't. They just leave it lying there and they approve the home study. So mm-hmm. again, there's that. The flip side that I wanted to get to is, you know, sometimes a home study is denied, and you should read those critically too. Sometimes they get denied for finances, and you should really look into that and go, well, wait a minute. Why are you keeping this child away from their family? Sometimes they don't calculate the aid that would come with the child and would help support the placement and make it more financially feasible to care for the child. And sometimes I've had cases with a grandmother who, yeah, the finances didn't work, and it didn't look like she'd be able to feed the child. But, you know, she's got an extended family of, like, she's got, like, 8 children of her own in town, and they're all working, and they're all like, no, 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 no. We're going to take care of mom, and we're going to make sure she can, grandma can care for these our nieces and nephews if she takes them in, you know. So you, and that doesn't get reflected in the home study, this family support. So if I can bring 5 people into court to tell the judge, you know, we all have good incomes, no one's going to starve, judge. No one's going to starve if we put the kids with grandma, you know, approve right. the home study. So that's the flip side of it.
Yeah. So another thing to keep in mind in evaluating placements is where you visit the child. A lot of the trainings that we go to focus on making sure that you visit the child in the home, and you absolutely should. There's no substitute for that. But if a child is wanting to leave or is complaining about the home, or really under any circumstance, you also really want to have the opportunity to talk with the child away from the caregivers and away from the home so that you can ask those basic questions and know that they feel comfortable sharing what is true for them with you.
Right. You need to remember the dynamic of the person you're talking to, right, is that they rely upon the placement for everything. And the younger they are, the more dependent they are on them for food, for clothing, for shelter, you know, for bathing, you name it. So if there is something wrong, it's a big ask to think that the child is going to feel comfortable telling you. And certainly being inside the home, it's almost impossible because everything there is set up to silence the child if there is something bad going on. And, you know, I know we sound paranoid again, but, you know, these are the things that we want to look for because, unfortunately, these are the things that happen in child welfare on occasion. So you do want to talk to the child outside the home, and you want to look for red flags, and you want to pay attention to your own instincts, which brings us to our fourth and final point today, which is paying attention to your instincts, not only when you're talking to the child. You're looking at their body language, you're listening to what they're saying, and you're listening to what they're not saying. Well, if they're saying, I want to go back to this dangerous situation that I told you I hated previously, and now I want to go back there. Maybe what they're saying is, I'm mm-hmm. not happy where I am. Why? Okay. Don't ignore your instinct. When you hear a little voice in your head saying, could this kid be telling me they're not happy, but I really like that foster mom? Or, you know, I had another kid that did really well in that home. Mm-hmm. Don't ignore the instinct, right? Jim and I had a professor of Gothic architecture. Don't ask me why we took that course. And he used
I was
to
gonna say,
say
sounds
it's a great course. But he used to like climb on the roofs of Notre Dame and all these cathedrals. What a great life. But he used to say, if you ever walk into a building and you look around and you don't feel safe, get out of the building, because you're not an architect, you're not an engineer, but your mind is doing math that you don't comprehend, and your instincts are telling you get out. We are the only beings on the planet that will ignore our instincts, right? If you're in a parking garage, the elevator opens, there's someone in it that mm-hmm. makes you feel unsafe. Every other animal will go in the opposite direction. Human beings will get in the elevator because we don't want to insult anyone. So we ignore our instincts. Mm-hmm. We can't. Right. We can't do that. So you're looking you're at a placement and you're looking for red flags. You're like, why are there cameras in every room? Right. Well, you know, maybe they're a little security conscious. No, don't ignore, you know, they won't leave you alone with the child. What's that about? Well, maybe they're just nosy. You know, why are they calling the kid a different name than the kid's actual name? You know, and again, I said, we're not looking under beds and we're not opening the refrigerators. However, you know, I've had my staff come to me and say, there's this locked door in the home and it's always locked. And the kid says, no one goes in there. What's behind the locked door? You know, don't insist to open the door, but just, you know, share the information with the case manager and be aware that your instincts are there for a reason, right? And pay attention to them. They might just save your client from a really sad outcome, or from some harm, or from something unhealthy happening to them. So I hope this has helped, that you understand your role a little more with regard to that critical piece of your client's case, the placement. You know, we want to reiterate that we know many of you have no control over placements, and they are limited in most areas, and they're in short supply. So what we've tried to focus on today are the big ticket items regarding placements that you should be alert for and you should act upon wherever possible. As always, thanks for listening. And please, if you haven't, leave us a review so others can find us, and subscribe so we can let you know about new episodes and other projects that we are engaged in.
Thanks, everybody, for listening. You've been listening to the Children's Law Podcast, brought to you by True North Child Advocates. Please take a moment to subscribe and spread the word. Thank you.